Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, well, you've all heard about them, but did they ever really exist? An Illuminati special. We hear from two authors on the historical Masonic group that planned, in the late 18th century, to dominate the world. Joe Wages is a Mason himself, an editor of Ritual and Doctrines of the Illuminati, followed by David Livingston from the Conspiracy School website. The 2007 book he wrote, Terrorism and the Illuminati. Joe is from the United States and David is Canadian. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm Joe Wages. I'm the editor of the Secret School of Wisdom. We published it back in 2015, and it was, you know, pretty much the entire Illuminati ritual system put back together from all the extant manuscripts and archive.
Where did you find this material? Because for many people, they think of the Illuminati as some kind of crazy fantasy.
Right. So the Illuminati, in fact, was a historical group that lasted from about 1776 to 1788. This material is mainly housed in the Secret State Archives in Berlin. But there's also manuscripts that we consulted from Frankfurt, Hamburg, and then one of them was in The Hague also, in various lodge archives. But the one in The Hague is the George Close Masonic papers at the Prince Frederick Institution in The Hague.
For those of them who have never come across them before, who are the Illuminati or who were they?
Well, the Illuminati originally was formed as sort of like an honors academic college fraternity, something like a Phi Beta Kappa. But as the members started graduating,
well, what is Phi Beta Kappa? Most people in Britain have never heard of that.
Oh, sure. So in the U.S., it's a honors academic fraternity. There's not really a formal initiation ritual per se. It's more of like just like an honors thing where you're an exemplary student in school or in university. And so it's something along the lines of this. And so the Illuminati itself is more like a college fraternity in the beginning. But as the members start graduating, they decide to start joining lodges. And that's where they get the idea that to really expand the order's influence, that they need to merge up with Freemasonry, mainly because they need more members and, more importantly, money. Because if you have a institution founded by a college professor and funded by college students, you're not likely to have a lot of money. So the main idea was to merge with Freemasonry.
You've had a look at the rituals. Tell us about what surprised you, what you found there about them. And as I understand it, through most of these secret societies, they have a system of degrees. And so what differentiates the degrees and what's in those rituals, if you can just give us a bit of a flavor?
Oh, sure. So the first degree, their novice degree, has no ceremony at all. It's like a probationary period where you're in contact with like the person who brings you into the order. You're observed, made sure to be able to be trusted. And then they bring you into the second degree, their Minerval degree. And the Minerval degree, it's loosely structured like a Masonic lodge. It has a tracing board, things of this nature. But it's like the book says, the Secret School of Wisdom. It's the actual Secret School of Wisdom where the curriculum that was censored by the Jesuits is taught and so forth.
And so what sort of curriculum is that? I mean, you're speaking in quite general terms, but can you get specific about what exactly the Jesuits have to do with this and what influence and what they would have been saying in these degrees?
Yeah, sure. So, okay, so maybe we step back just for a second. So the Enlightenment in Germany comes rather late. So, we have the War of Austrian Succession in the 1740s, the Seven Years' War in the 1760s. And at the conclusion of the Seven Years' War, you've got basically Germany's divided up into two regions. It's mainly Protestant states in the north and Catholic states in the south. So Frederick the Great, he institutes a policy called Enlightened Absolutism. And basically, it's where they bring in agrarian land reforms, abolish serfdom, and compulsory public education. And so the curriculum is basically free in the North, but in the South, because they're more aligned with the Catholic Church, the Jesuits control the academic curriculum in the southern states, such as Bavaria, where the Illuminati come from. And so what ends up happening is that they have a like a real tight grip on like what's being taught. And so even in spite of all this, you know, they end up making reforms in Bavaria. So what happens is that the Jesuits are disbanded in 1773 or 4, I can't remember the year, by the Pope. And so it opens the door to non-Jesuit membership in the basically like the professorships. So Adam Weishaupt's the first professor who's not a Jesuit to receive the position of canon law. And the trouble with the, all this is so the Jesuits are disbanded, academia is opened up to non-Jesuits for positions. And at the same point in time, Maximilian III, who's the Duke of Bavaria, he brings in the Bavarian Academy of Sciences. So it's starting to come in, and then he dies, and he has no heir. And so his cousin, Carl Theodore, takes the reins of leading Bavaria, basically. And he basically puts the Jesuits back into control. So it kind of motivates Weishaupt to make the secret school of wisdom. So all the things that he was, for a small period of time, starting to teach, he has to do it in secret. And so that's kind of the main reason why they formed the Illuminati in the first place, is to teach all the ideals of the Enlightenment, and not just philosophy, but also science, reason, rationalism, these sorts of things. And, you know, subjects we might be all sorts of scientific topics like, you know, optics, things like this, but also philosophy, even the study of other secret societies. These are the things that are taught in the secret school of wisdom in this Minerval Assembly I'm talking about.
Okay, so I guess that's the second degree. Is it the Minerval?
Yes, and then the third degree after that is Minervalis Illuminatus or Illuminatus Minor. And in this one, it's basically the leadership of this Minerval Assembly. And to get this position, you have to already be a Freemason of the third degree. And what it's basically doing is giving you like the skills necessary for leadership. And so they're basically the officers in this Minerval Assembly. So the officers of the Minerval Assembly, they had to be a Freemason of the third degree to be able to have this position. And their actual initiation ceremony looks a lot like in the 18th century, officer's table lodge setup. What they're basically doing is they're being given reins for leading the Minerval Assembly. And that's loosely the idea. So the ceremony isn't very elaborate. And so all the different symbols and stuff on their tracing board in the Minerval degree, it's all explained to them and what all these different symbols mean, that kind of thing.
So as part of these rituals, are they swearing oaths of various sorts? If so, what?
Oh, sure. There's oaths all the way up into the regent degree in every degree. In the Masonic degrees, it's all the standard Masonic obligations. You can read about all these different Masonic obligations online.
Well, which are? Give us some examples. What sort of obligations?
Well, basically that they're not going to reveal the secrets of Freemasonry, and then there's penalties, of course, and everyone's familiar with those penalties. But as far as the Minerva
stuff
goes...
Well, hang on. I mean, they're not necessarily. I mean, the penalties, if I'm right, are they not death penalties?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. What's interesting is, to make their Masonic system different and unique from other Masonic systems, they combine all the penal signs, or not the penal signs, the obligations into the first degree. And then so that way in the second and third degree for their Masonic rituals, they waive all obligations or swearing of obligations for a handshake. And that's one of the features that makes them distinct from the other Masonic degrees at the time. But, so, you know, it's basically... go ahead.
So what sort of... oaths are they swearing? Because this is one of the things I think people find a little bit dangerous about this type of organization, is that they are basically saying, well, you know, if I break the rules of the organization can kill me, which is slightly sinister. But in what sort of ways, are they swearing oaths that they can be killed in the Illuminati degrees?
In the actual Minerval degree, Illuminatus Minor degree, Scottish Novice, Scottish Knight, the oaths that they're really swearing is that they're going to maintain inviolable secrecy. So the only ones that have like the so-called death penalty are the ones in the Masonic degrees itself. but those aren't unique to the Illuminati. They're kind of patterned off of Freemasonry. So if we look at it from a larger perspective, they're using Freemasonry as a vehicle for expansion. So the Illuminati's like subversion is less to do with civil society and more to do with Freemasonry. But I'm not saying that there's not a push towards global governance. You'd be a fool to say the opposite of that. And the ultimate idea is to impact and change the world for the better. So they're not advocating for the violent overthrow of governments per se, but what they're advocating for is the influence of government. So one of the things they say several times in the rituals is that, you can overthrow a government and you'll get no change for the better, and more than likely than not, the change for the worse. So the idea is for the heads of state, whether they be dukes or kings or princes or so forth, is to surround them with advisors educated in their system to prevent these people from making the wrong decisions or doing things that are, not in the interest of the society and are, maybe motivated by their own interest.
Okay, so if you go up above the Minerval degrees, what do we get then?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so after the Minerval degree, you've got Illuminatus Minor, like we talked about, so that's the leadership. And then you also have to be a Freemason of the third degree at this point. And then it shifts into the Masonic class of degrees, where you've got your Intern Apprentice, Fellow Craft, and Master Mason's degrees, and on top of the Masonic edifice. And one thing to note is that it's remarkably not dissimilar from other Masonic systems at this point in time. So, the standard Masonic ritual, there's variations from system to system, but for the most part, they're all generally the same. But what's unique about this system is that they have Scottish degrees on top of this. And by Scottish, it doesn't mean it necessarily emanates from Scotland. But remember, they're trying to build like the veneer of authenticity that this is, in fact, a legitimate Masonic system. And so what they're doing is they're putting on top of it where it looks like the tradition in Germany. Maybe we need to take a step back here and explain it that the high degrees, per se, they really come from England itself. And so in the 1730s, you start seeing this thing called the Scots Master Degree. It's exported to Berlin in 1742 in a lodge called L'Union. And they have this thing called the Scots Master Degree, which, of course, comes from England. And then they add a ceremony on top of it, like a knighting, so you become a Scottish knight. And so what you end up seeing is that they copy the same pattern where they have Scottish novice and Scottish knight, and they're basically taking the already existing Masonic structure and grafting onto it. But so if we look at it from a structural point of view, the rituals and ceremonies matter very little, but it's the lectures that are where the real fireworks are, because Weishaupt, he himself only advances to be a Fellow Craft Freemason, but never makes it to Master Mason because he loses interest. So he's ill-equipped to write rituals and ceremonies from that perspective. And so when we think about the rituals of the Illuminati, really it's a hybrid of collaboration. So you've got Baron von Knigge, who writes all the ceremony ritual work, and then you have Adam Weishaupt, who's writing all of the lectures and obligations and things like this. And so it's really like the Illuminati's work isn't just one person. It's really a collaboration of two people.
So what about the highest degrees? What are they called if you work your way up to be one of the top people in this old German secret society? And what things are they swearing oaths to, and what's involved with making it up to those top degrees?
Well, that's one of the surprising things about it, is that the ritual system was incomplete. So, we have like two competing visions for the Illuminati. Knigge wants to make a Masonic high degree system, whereas Adam Weishaupt wants a secret school of wisdom, and both of them see themselves as the main force in this effort to collaborate and produce these rituals. And what ends up happening is Knigge demits from the order because of personal conflict with Weishaupt, and so he finishes everything up to the regent degree, which are what they call the lesser mysteries. But the greater mysteries are the degrees, they're called Docetus and Philosophi. So Docetus degree, like if we think about, what is Docetism? Well, it's an early Christian heresy, and that heresy says that, Jesus didn't really suffer on the cross, that, he only appeared to have a human form, but he didn't really. And what's interesting is that title doesn't have anything to do with the text, because what the text is really about is, you know, proving the existence of God and the immortality of the soul through logical, secular reasoning, which sounds strange, and it is kind of strange. The thing is, like, that, you know, Weishaupt, he's pretty much a sophist, so he's got this beautiful, eloquent cadence of things, and so his ideas, though completely and utterly philosophically unsound, it sounds really, really good the way he presents the ideas. And so, you know, it's basically a bullet point list of different ideas, and it jumps all the way through from where he talks about matter, you know, things aren't as they appear, our senses, you know, they're not necessarily all the senses in the world. So it's kind of like a pie in the sky type thing where he uses logical secular reasoning to prove the immortality of the soul and the existence of God. And what's interesting about all this is, you know, Weishaupt, up until like the death of his first wife, was a materialist. So he didn't really believe much in God at all. But after she dies, he's trying to rationalize this loss. And so what you end up seeing is he embraces this this view of what they call idealism. You know, there's a French philosopher, kind of not very well known, a guy named Bonnet, and he's really influenced by this one paper. And so it gives him this idea to, you know, kind of compare materialism versus idealism. And ultimately, you get the Docetist degree out of it. And that's for the lower degree and the greater mysteries. And then the upper degree, the philosophy degree, it's a continuation of the lecture from the priest degree, which basically says, and it's, I don't know if you've ever read Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin of Human Inequality, but, you know, later he goes on to develop that into the social contract. Have you ever read that before?
No.
Okay, are you there, Tony?
Yes. No, I haven't read that, no.
Okay, so just briefly, like, Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin of Human Inequality, again, is another philosophically unsound, you know, argument. And what it basically says is that mankind starts in a primitive state, and in this primitive state that he's completely free, because all he needs to provide for is for himself and for his family. But over time, mankind is enslaved by the progress of society and the multiplication of his needs, and to where it becomes to such a point where, through the interconnectedness and development of society, that, you know, ultimately mankind is enslaved by their needs. So the only way to attain pure liberty and pure happiness and pure freedom is to limit one's needs and to require very little from life. And so it's kind of like a minimalist philosophy. Now, one of the arguments that he makes in here, I think you'll find to be quite interesting, is that he says that if we want to bring about the perfection and the enlightenment of the world, it's necessary to increase the population and not to decrease the population, because by the you know, the higher competition for needs, it actually brings about this thing where you know, through the competition of needs and resources by an increasing population, that what it ultimately leads to is people curbing their needs for these, you know, different resources they're competing for. And so that supposedly brings about the perfection of humanity, which again is philosophically unsound, but the way he wrote it, it sounds really nice.
So what about the top? I mean, I imagine, like most secret societies, there's some kind of master at the top, whether it's a grand master. What is it in the Illuminati?
Well, it shifts. So in the beginning part, from 1776 to about 86, Adam Weishaupt is the head of this order. And so he styles himself as Spartacus. Like, if you'll think back in history, Spartacus was the liberator of the Roman slaves. And that's kind of the way he sees himself. Like, he calls himself the general of the order. But, you know, on paper, it's founded as more of like a democratic type institution. So this thing is called the Areopagus. And if you'll think of your Greek history, you know, the Areopagus was the ruling body over Athens. And so it's kind of like at odds. You have a system that's supposed to be functioning as a democracy, but ultimately is really functioning as a despotism. Or, you know, and the thing is, Weishaupt, he leads this thing until he's forced to go into exile. And so when he goes into exile, another gentleman by the name of Johann Joachim Bode takes over the order, and he runs it until about 1788. And ultimately, it kind of dies out. And so in our archival evidence, you can see the correspondence. And there's, you know, 20,000-something pages of this stuff that still exists. You can see that there's like a big curve that it follows, where You've got a lot of activity that builds up, goes really high, and then after about 1785, you see the correspondence kind of tail off. So, like, if you were to graph it, it looks like a nice little bell curve. And, you know, it's just, it's further evidence that there's, you know, little continued activity.
So, no master, no grandmaster.
No. So it's Weishaupt at first and then Botha at second. But really what ends up happening is they banned the Illuminati through a series of edicts in Bavaria. And so if you're the Bavarian Illuminati, that kind of decapitates the order. And so these northern states, which, you know, you can write an edict in Bavaria and it has no bearing on some of these other states in Germany.
Organization that was created by Weishaupt have any influence on the French Revolution? Because I know there's a lot of people that believe that it was one of the groups that was instrumental in making the French Revolution happen.
Well, that's it. What's interesting about it. So Botha, in 87, he goes into Paris, and there's this Lodge Les Amis Réunis, or the United Friends, and he goes to this conference, and this lodge is an occultist lodge, which is actually quite at odds with the Illuminati system, where they're all into rationalism and reason. These guys are into the more like the esoteric and occult type sciences. And so Botha goes there because he's wanting to get into their archive because they collect all these different Masonic degrees. And Botha was a Mason before he was in the Illuminati. So he's looking to look at their archive, but more importantly, he's looking to start up a lodge there. And so what he ends up doing is, He talks to the leadership in this lodge, a guy named Savalette de Lange, and Savalette agrees that, you know, that they'll only take the lower part of the Illuminati's ritual system, so that secret school of wisdom, but it's so the education and all the different ideas that we talked about, that really gets transplanted, but it's only briefly, and, you know, they quickly lose interest in it because, you know, if this group's, you know, raison d'etre is to be, you know, an occult society studying reason and rationalism, there's not going to be found to be very interesting by the members. And so, yes, there's an attempt to go into Paris, but it ultimately fails. Like after, you know, just a couple of years, there's not really even a lot of activity going on, a couple of letters back and forth, and that's about it. And so they just kind of lose interest in the whole idea.
Okay. Have you had a look at the Wilhelm Bad conference and the significance of that?
Oh, sure. And that's really how the Illuminati got the bulk of its members, because up until 1782, they maybe had like 300 members in the Illuminati. You know, ultimately they expand to 2000. So, you know, where do they pick up the other 1700 members? Well, this happens at the Conference of Wilhelmsbad. So in 1782, Knigge goes to the Wilhelmsbad Convention, and what they're basically trying to resolve with this Wilhelmsbad Convention is, are there these unknown superiors directing this rite called the Strict Observance? Well, the Strict Observance is the dominant rite in Germany at this point in time. And what ends up happening is that, you know, after kind of working the ideas out and then putting it out that these unknown superiors should attend, no one shows up. And so they say, right, so we can't call ourselves the Knights Templar anymore. And that's the end of it. And so what it ends up happening is, if you've got the dominant rite in a Masonic system, for a whole country, and it's now declared to be a fraud, you've got a power vacuum. And so all these different reforms of Freemasonry spring up. And so, and it's at this convention, as a matter of fact, that where Knigge recruits Botha to join the Illuminati. And so all these members come from the decay of this former secret society, the Strict Observance, and that's where the bulk of the membership of the Illuminati comes from.
What prompted you to look at this, Joe?
Well, I was curious about it just like everybody else. And so one of the first books I read was Proofs of a Conspiracy. And so as I was reading through the sources, like in his footnotes, I noticed that it was horribly rendered German titles. And so I started collecting those books. Then I sort of started corresponding with Reinhard Markner, who's probably like the leading scholar in Europe on the Illuminati. And then we, you know, started working together. Then I started collecting all the primary sources. And then, you know, at the idea, I was like, well, you know, you keep hearing all these different things. You know, what is the Illuminati about? And, you know, parts of the ritual, you know, were published in the, you know, 1780s and 1790s. And just by reading those, I figured out pretty quickly that they got the whole thing wrong. And that the reason why there are all these conspiracies have sprung up is that there's a complete power complete vacuum of information. So you've got a language barrier, and you've also got an accessibility barrier. So you've got, you know, Robeson and Barrowell, who write all these different ideas motivated by different, you know, influences to write against the Illuminati. You know, you look at John Robeson, he's a former Scottish Freemason, and he's not really keen on the whole French Revolution, and for good cause, because, I mean, if you look at the atrocities that happened there, I mean, it's hard to embrace that as the rights of man when it only ultimately leads to, like, the guillotining of thousands of people and basically the destruction of the church and so forth. So, you know, rightfully, he's disgusted by this whole thing. Also, he's prompted because there's a thing called the United Irishmen that spring up in the 1790s, like loosely associated Jacobin clubs. And so he kind of writes against it. And so his intel, as I mentioned before, the sources aren't written correctly in German. It told me that he probably didn't speak German. And then after looking further into it, he was actually being fed information by a British spy in Regensburg who had these books as they were published and was feeding him information back and forth. And then, so that's the Scottish angle. Then the French angle is Augustin Barrowell. He wrote in his memoirs on the history of Jacobinism, volume 3, about the Illuminati. And so from his perspective, you know, you have these books that come out right after the French Revolution, you know, all these are not right after, right before the French Revolution and during, talking about the Illuminati. And then you see all these horrible things happening, and it leads him to, you know, put two and two together that, well, the Illuminati must have caused all of this. These things, and the Illuminati themselves, like, how do they stand from a religious perspective? They were more of deists than anything, so they believe in, you know, God, the immortality of the soul, but that all, you know, works of revealed religions are essentially just that. They're the works of man and not the divine inspired word of God. That's their perspective on these issues.
Yeah, the best way to describe deism, I think, is probably something along the lines of God minus the Bible. But anyway, look, one of the...
That's right.
What's the relevance today? Is there any? Because you seem to be saying that all this Illuminati stuff is just a great big conspiracy.
Well, it is, and the thing is like the Illuminati weren't the first to use that name. There were groups before them, the Alumbrados in Spain, the Illuminés of Avignon. They all came before them. There's groups after them that used the name. And so what's the impact of all this work? Well, if you look at the different books out there, what they ultimately end up doing is providing a template for people to copy off of to make their own secret societies. So although Robeson and Barrowell's books are in condemnation of the Illuminati, some of the things they publish in there give other groups later on the ideas of how to build a similar structure. And so there are groups after them that have used the same name, but none of them are direct continuations of the original group. And it doesn't really matter because what was preserved, although trying to expose them during these exposures that were put out, it actually gives fuel to the fire, not put it out. So that's kind of an interesting point to me. But a larger issue, I think, too, is like if the people want to make real and lasting and impactful change in the world, chasing soap bubbles and like fictitious groups probably isn't the best way to go, because it's a total, you know, it's like a dog that sits on the rug and chases its tail. It's never going to catch the tail, and it keeps spinning in circles around and around and around. So if you want to make real change and make an impact in the world today, stop chasing your tail and go directly at the issues that matter to you. You know, some people are into, you know, sovereignty and things like this. Other people are into, you know, human rights. And these are all great things to be involved in and to advocate for. So just pick what it is that you fit in and go for it and make a difference instead of like going after a group that's been, you know, dead for the last 240 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What about Freemasonry? Because that's not dead. And it does seem as if there certainly is some kind of secret organization behind the scenes which is manipulating governments. Or is it, do you think, just simply human greed?
Well, like myself, I'm a 32nd degree Freemason myself. All the things that I've encountered, like, would lead me to believe the opposite. If you think about it, like, you know, super rich people, and I'm not saying that there's not a push towards global governance, you'd be a fool to say the opposite of that. But what I am saying is that, you know, rich and wealthy people who are trying to make a difference or reshape the world in their, you know, their own likeness, you know, guys like Soros and stuff like that, you're never going to find these guys in a Masonic lodge, and you're never going to find them contributing to a Masonic lodge, because if you look at it, you know, these people have so much money that really the only thing that motivates them is power. And so a lot of the Masonic lodges that you'll find in the world today are really about like serving, you know, serving society, like different charities and these sorts of things. And so that's another one of those things where people go after like Masonic groups thinking that it's the end all be all of power, when really the end all be all of power is more interested in obtaining and maintaining power as opposed to being involved in some groups.
I suppose you know it's power is like a drug, really. I mean, it's once you're hooked on it, it's difficult to get off of it. Anyway, Joe, could you just remind us of your book and whereabouts people could get hold of it if they're interested?
Oh, sure. So in the UK, you can go to Lewis Masonic and order the book, or you can go to Amazon. Was it .co.uk or .com.uk? I can't remember. Or if you're in the US, you can go to Amazon.com and pick it up. We've got it in French, English, German. So just whatever language you guys like, you know, there's a copy for you out there somewhere.
And the title again?
Is The Secret School of Wisdom.
By?
Oh, by Joseph Wages and Reinhard Markner, translated by Jiva Singh Anand.
Joe Wages, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, very, very welcome. Thank you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is David Livingstone. I'm an independent historian. I operate a website called conspiracyschool.com, and that's where I feature articles that are related to the five books that I've written. I'm currently finishing my last one, which is called Ordo Ad Chao, which means Order Out of Chaos. And what I specialize in is the history of the occult and the occult influence on history. So my first book is called The Dying God, The Hidden History of Western Civilization. And that's the one that really goes back to the origin of the occult. So it really tries to, because the challenge with the occult is that it's a topic that is rarely discussed in academia. Obviously, it's not taught in school. The history of occult, the occultist's own history is basically a mythology, but it contains certain kernels of truth. So the trick is to try to get an accurate version of history. And although it's not covered in depth anywhere by any historian, there are historians who have covered various aspects, and I've tried my best to try to piece together various findings to put the story together. So what I trace most of it back to is basically all modern occultism is traced back to the Hebrew Kabbalah. So that's what I discuss in my book, The Dying God, which traces it back to Babylon.
But hang on, David, sorry, but you know, the Kabbalah surely is something that came through a book called the Zohar, which, as I understand it, is actually a medieval book. It doesn't go back to Babylon at all.
Well, not directly. So the sources. So Kabbalah is a very interesting history. It basically, what happens is that it appears all of a sudden in the mid 1200s, sometime after the Crusades. So the scholar who opened this topic is Gershom Scholem. And so he's got several books. And so there's two aspects of it. So the first thing he tries to explore is what are the origins of the Kabbalah? How did the Kabbalah appear all of a sudden in the 12th century in Germany and France, when it was a tradition that had basically been all but disappeared for almost 1,000 years? And what he traces it to a kind of mysticism called Merkabah mysticism. And the earliest examples of it are found with the Essenes. But it's actually from mystical traditions that back before that, and that's what I try to trace. So the very curious case about the Kabbalah is that there's several scholars who've tried to trace its origins. Of course, there have been many occult historians over the years because in its own mythology, it's traced back to Solomon or to, you know, even further back to Moses and so on and so forth. But most academics recognize that that's not accurate. And there's been competing theories to try to trace it to either to Iran, to Babylon, or to Greece, and even Egypt. And so basically what I answer in my book, Dying God, is why that confusion arises. And there's a very important book, one of the most important books of ancient history that I know of, by a Belgian scholar named Franz Cumont. And he's the founder of the study of Mithraism, which of course played an important role in influencing Christianity. So his studies of Mithraism have been dismissed because people don't understand what he was saying. And because he was a scholar of rare breadth of knowledge. And what he recognized is that in the 6th century in Babylon, what happened is that there emerged a cult of Magi who were heretical Zoroastrians. And this is the point that most scholars don't get. Because if you look for traces of Zoroastrianism and Mithraism, they don't exist. It is not in any way related. But what you can find is that in those early times, there was this cult that was influencing various religious and philosophical traditions, which was mostly traced back to Zoroaster, but falsely attributed to him. And so he calls this magian cult the Magicians, to differentiate them from Orthodox Zoroastrians. And they are basically worshippers of Lucifer, to make a long story short. So what you find is that after the Persians conquered Babylon, these Magi spread to the various parts of the world. They go to Egypt, and in Egypt, their influence gives rise to Hermeticism. And what the history books don't tell you is that Greek philosophy first emerged on the coast, the far western coast of Turkey, which happened to be then under Persian occupation. But it's in those early Greek city-states where philosophers emerged, and it's clear that in all cases, they represented manifestations of Magian or pseudo-Magian influence. And so this is what causes the confusion, and this is why what happens is that after Alexander conquers those various parts of the Middle East and incepts the Hellenistic age, you get this confluence of all these various strains of occult or mystical traditions. And that's why scholars refer to it as syncretism, because these various strains all come together and meld and then create new variations. So the most important streams are the Egyptian one, which is Hermeticism, the Greek one, which is Greek philosophy, and the Iranian or Persian one, which is Mithraism, and the Jewish one, which is Merkabah mysticism. So what happens at this time is that all these various traditions sort of co-influence or inter-influence each other, and then you get these new influences, especially Neoplatonism and Gnosticism. And Gnosticism is basically just an adaptation of Merkabah mysticism to Christianity.
Now, you talk about the Mithraism, and I mean, it's also useful, I think, if you can just define what Mithraism is and what is the occult too. Can you come up with a sort of easy, workable definition of the occult?
So why I call my book The Dying God is because it's a reference to the cult of the dying and resurrecting God. This is a tradition that was first popularized or highlighted by James Frazer, who wrote The Golden Bough. And what it is that in various parts of the ancient Middle East, you have this worship of this dying and resurrecting God, and typically married to a spouse or a goddess. The god represents the sun, and the spouse is Venus. And so this is an ancient fertility cult, which meant that it followed the seasons. So the sun died in the winter or on the solstice and came back to life in the springtime at the equinox, or was resurrected. And so what you find is that this cult was worshipped in most parts of the ancient Middle East, but this with different names attributed to the god, and just slight variations in the mythology. But typically, they were the same. He was also a god of the underworld, so he was believed to that when he died, he descended to the underworld, and so that's why he was worshipped as what's called a chthonic deity or an underworld deity, which was typically associated with evil. So in Mesopotamia, he was worshipped as Marduk or Bel, or Baal in the Bible. In Greece, he had many manifestations like Dionysus, Apollo, Hermes. In Egypt, he was Osiris. And so in Persia, he was Mithras. And this is where this cult was attributed to Zoroaster, but it was as legitimately connected to Zoroaster as Gnosticism is to Jesus. So what was typical in these times was for what they call pseudepigrapha, which is basically texts that were falsely attributed to various saints and sages. So you have all these texts, like there are a number of them that were found, if I get this right, the Qumran or the Dead Sea Scrolls, were texts attributed to Abraham or Enoch. And so similarly, you have these number of texts that were attributed to Zoroaster or to his pupil, whose name was Osthenes. And so these texts were basically, you know, the original occult influences of the ancient world. So back again to Mithraism is basically a pseudo-Zoroastrian. I have an article online which where I call it Zoroastrian Gnosticism, because that's pretty much what it is, just to make sure that there's no confusion between the two, to understand really what Mithraism is. And it's basically just one and the same as the various ancient mysteries and the Gnostic traditions that emerged in Hellenistic times.
So what about ancient Babylon, though? I mean, you know, you've got there Nimrod, characters like him, his so-called goddess wife, Semiramis. And how do they fit in with this strain? Because obviously the Babylonians were quite an important force.
Yeah, so those stories of Nimrod are pretty hard to trace. So what's important is that, and this is what Frank Kimmel identifies, is that this cult can be traced no further back than the 6th century BC. So probably a lot of these older stories were just part of the more ancient legends that were incorporated into this newer cult. And it's typical occultism to incorporate mythologies and to basically create an ancient pedigree for itself far beyond what is actually correct. So the most important development in this cult is astrology. And the scholars have established that astrology could not have predated the 6th century BC because it was not until then that an adequate calendar was developed that allowed them to trace the course of the stars. And so this is why Frank Kimmel shows that this Magician cult, as he calls it, was a mix of this Babylonian religion plus three things ultimately: astrology, numerology, and magic. And so this is why basically the word magic itself is derived from the Magi.
Now, what relevance does this have for any of us today, David?
Everything. Donald Trump. You know, World War I, the Holocaust, democracy, secularism, Freemasonry, you know, the various versions of Christianity that are flourishing in various parts of the Western world, mystical cults like Sufism.
Well, let's just take one of those. Let's just take Donald Trump. In what way is he somehow connected to these ancient cults?
So this is what I'm discussing in my latest book. And Merkawa and Mithraism were basically variations of the same. These were all Gnostic cults, and they were just different versions of Gnosticism. So Merkaba was Jewish Gnosticism, Mithraism was Zoroastrian Gnosticism, and then there's Christian Gnosticism. And this is what gave birth to the Western cult tradition. And what happened is that Gnosticism in particular had some, and especially the Mithraism in particular, had a very profound influence on Christianity, which is why Jesus is supposedly born on December 25th, and then resurrects at Easter, which is the equivalent of very near to the spring equinox. This is all basically the influence of Mithraism or ancient mystery.
So, well, hang on, because many people will say, well, actually, the Easter is based on the Passover, which is a Jewish tradition of being released from captivity in Egypt. So not necessarily the spring equinox.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Passover itself could be pagan influence as well, too. So what happens is that there's this competition basically to decide which books belong in the Bible. And it's not until, as we all know, the Nicene Conference that in the third century, in the fourth century, when they decide, the basics of the canon. But one book remained in dispute and wasn't accepted until the early 400s, and that's the Book of Revelation. And the Book of Revelation is not a book, it's not a gospel. So it's not attributable to Jesus or to Paul. It's a revelation, apparently, revelation accorded to St. John. And so the reason why it was so controversial is because for the longest time, many of the Christian fathers were unsure about the authorship, and there were consistent claims that it was written by a Gnostic named Corinthus. I think it's pretty clear, depending on your theological disposition, it's pretty clear that the Book of Revelation is a Kabbalistic book. Or we should say, a proto-Kabbalistic book. So this is basically what Albert Pike claims. And Albert Pike is, as you know, was the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, wrote Morals and Dogma, which is pretty much the Bible of Freemasonry. And in that book, he claims that this Gnostic Corinthus is the original author of the Book of Revelation, that the Book of Revelation is a Kabbalistic book, which is coded, and this is why Masons revere St. John, because he's a supposed author of the Book of Revelation, and that the Book of Revelation is the blueprint that outlines the plans to fulfill the Masonic agenda, which is what's called the Great Work, or, in other words, rebuilding the Temple of Solomon. So that's basically the origin of, that's the whole plan. And out of Albert Pike comes all of the right-wing traditions that developed into the Fascist International, who worked together over decades to bring about the election of a person like Donald Trump.
Okay, so what about the latest developments in computers? Because I know one of your books is about transhumanism, and this is quite an interesting development. Literally just this week, switched on in Manchester, the first ever computer that mimics the human brain, funded by the European Union. It used to be anyone that knows Manchester from the last couple of maybe 20 years or so, will know it as UMIS, the University of Manchester Institute of Science and Technology. And they have actually just switched this computer on. Apparently it has roughly the power of the brain of a rat.
Which is phenomenal for a computer.
So what do you make of this development in computer technology? And I wonder if you think it might be, part of a wider plan for technology or technocracy even.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think what's related, I was just watching Al Jazeera just finally managed to publish one of their documentaries on the Israel lobby. And what they reveal is pretty much their persistent use of technology, and especially algorithms, to track how people communicate online and to follow trends that they might consider anti-Israeli or what they call anti-Semitic. That really tells you what is really happening. So I think we discussed this before, but the computer since the beginning was going back to the 1940s when the cybernetics group was first put together, the goal has always been to create artificial intelligence, to create as Norbert Wiener called, a god, or for humans to become god by creating a golem. So, as the goal of cybernetics, the goal is, as Norbert Wiener called, the control of humans and machines. But humans machines are analogous to human beings. So a computer is just the most sophisticated machine which manages to fully emulate a human being right down to the working of his mind. And the purpose is to get control. So I think we're finally starting to see the results. We use all this technology every day, and it's marketed to us as having advantages for helping us socialize and communicate. But really, they're platforms that are designed to plug us into the system and to monitor us. So especially, obviously, Facebook and Twitter, which are the flagships, and Google as well. Yeah, and so that's what's interesting about how all these tools were used, particularly to help coordinate support for Donald Trump. So that's why when you look at, part of what I look at is the relationships between Cambridge Analytica. And so Peter Thiel, who is the founder of PayPal, he's also the founder of a company called Palantir, which does work, which basically is a CIA-backed company that does sort of a data mining, basically. And it's Palantir that assisted Cambridge Analytica into stealing the private information of various Facebook accounts to build their database. And when you look at who owned Cambridge Analytica, it was Robert Mercer and Steve Bannon. Both of them were members of what's called the Council for National Policy, and that's the CNP. And the CNP is basically the top of the pyramid of the right-wing organizations in the United States that are linked to the broader Fascist International.
What about this latest book of yours, Ordo Ab Chao? That's translated from the Latin, means order from chaos. Why did you choose that title?
Right. Because the plan is to, what they're trying to do is fulfill the Book of Revelation, right? So you and I, or most people, would read it and see the predictions as terrible things to happen. But since these guys are Luciferians, they see it backwards. So that's why it's a blueprint. So they believe that they need to fulfill the chaos that is prophesied in the Book of Revelation in order to accelerate the coming of the Messiah. And this is stated almost verbatim, or explicitly, by Alexander Dugin, who is really the architect of the Russian influence campaign in the United States. And he basically says exactly that the Book of Revelation is not, he said that it's a task, it's a responsibility. And so they don't see, creating wars, destruction, famine, disease as a problem. They see it as a requirement, that it's all part of the necessary stages that have to happen to bring about the coming of the Messiah.
Now, is that the second coming? I mean, you talking about the second coming there, or what?
It's their Messiah, so it's the Antichrist.
Ah, I see. Okay, so sounds fascinating. Do you think that they're getting on quite well with their plan? Do you think this is going to all happen?
Of course, look at Donald Trump's in power. I mean, so it's worked marvelously well.
And what would you advise people who are using computers thinking, well, actually, this is quite a handy piece of kit and it's helping me? Because you're making it quite clear there are other sides to these little devices.
Yeah. Well, you just got to be, clever about it, I think. We don't have much choice but to use computers, and they are amazing tools. They're just abused. So, like I've said many times, it's a tool like any other. So, whether it's a wheel or a fire that can be used for, good or evil, they're amazing. I mean, I think they're even necessary. I think we live at a point in time in history where with the size of the world's population, we needed some kind of tool like this to bridge the distance. But, you know, that's despite the fact that it was invented for a very nefarious purpose. But we have to be smart about it. I think you're going to use it, but just, you know, don't be careful what kind of information you share. Try to limit it as much as you can, you know, and just be smart about it. I mean, you know, to a certain extent, I mean, there's only so much they can track. And really, you know, what are they going to track? You can't worry too much because, you know, like I think this example in the Al Jazeera documentary, they're tracking pro-Palestinian or anti-Israeli activists. So, you know, sometimes they're going to be tracking you doing what you're supposed to be doing. Just kind of the point. So there's only so much we have to worry about it because, you know, as long as you're not plotting to do anything illegal, there's not really any worry about them following what you're.
Okay. Well, what about, apart from your own books, obviously, are there any particular thinkers and writers you think, you know, a good way of getting up to speed with some of this technocratic dystopia that you're talking about?
There's a great article about the history of Google by Nafis Ahmed. I'm not sure where it is, somewhere online. It's really good. It's the only detailed history. You know, he wrote a great book called The War on Freedom, I think it was, like sometime after 9/11, which was one of the best books on 9/11. And yeah, so his article is pretty in-depth and very detailed and really shows all the, because I've seen a few articles and whatever trying to make claims of connections between the CIA and Facebook and Google, but none of them have been very substantial. And his article is pretty comprehensive.
So when we're using Google, that's the CIA, is it?
In many ways, yes. I mean, it's not so much just Google, it's Alphabet now, right? It's everything that they do. It's your email, it's your browsing history, it's all your activity online. Google, I mean, they just started out as a search company, but that wasn't really just it. There, you know, there's a fascinating case of when they were developing Google Maps. What happened is that they were driving this car around the world, but they were snooping. They were dropping in on people's internet connections, and it came a minor scandal called WiSpy. And what's curious is that the guy who was in charge of that project, he then went on to found Pokemon. He before he went to Pokemon, he was developing a patent for a technology that could use gaming for collecting personal information.
Well, that sounds that sounds almost criminal.
Well, it should be, but that's the problem. You know, the law is so far behind the technology that it's a bold frontier, and these guys are just, you know, grabbing as much territory as they can before the law catches up to them. It's completely out of control.
Now, David, final question. Could you give us any advice as to how to help avoid this dystopia or maybe to go around the side of it?
You have to educate yourself as much as you can, and that means a lot of effort. That means, you know, changing your focus in life, where knowledge, personal freedom becomes your priority above material comfort, career, reputation, all those things. You have to be willing to fully devote yourself to wanting to know the truth, wanting to be on the right path. And that will typically require a lot of effort and some personal sacrifice, but it's really the only true reward. And so learning, and most importantly, once you've learned, sharing knowledge, it's not something that we will overcome as individuals. It's something that we have to do collectively. But we need numbers, and that means millions of people. And the only way to do that is to share the information until hopefully someday you can create some kind of critical mass.
We should just say something about, you know, it's nice speaking to you, but we did have a bit of a problem, didn't we, with Skype and with Messenger. We were trying to speak on both of those.
Yeah.
And we were both online.
Yeah.
And yet, for some reason, Skype didn't want to talk this end in Bristol to where, whereabouts are you?
In Yellowknife in northern Canada.
So Yellowknife and Bristol didn't really want to talk on the internet from messenger to messenger, and they didn't want to talk from Skype to Skype. Why might that be?
No, that's a very good question. No idea.
Okay.
It could be suspicious, or it could just be something real.
Yes, yeah. could just be. Of course, it's just a coincidence, isn't it? All right. Nice to speak to you.
Okay.
Cheers. Great. Take care. Thanks. Bye.
Okay. See you.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Joseph Wages. He's a Freemason and editor of a book called Ritual and Doctrines of the Illuminati. Also, David Livingston of the Conspiracy School website, and he's author of the 2007 book Terrorism and the Illuminati. Thanks also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Josh Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're on 0117 909-6897 and online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some spare time, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect Crew, goodbye for now.